Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Wevel, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer A.A. Williams.
Like, it's like you don't even know me, man. I don't even know why I bother showing up sometimes.
It's going to be a great show, as we're going to be talking about the long-awaited sequel to the 1980 classic horror film The Shining, and that is Dr. Sleep. So stick around as we discuss the film that just dropped this past weekend, and we are excited to talk about it.
The Filmlosophers podcast rode the mini toy train and was brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios.
That's an in-movie reference, just in case. Just saying. Just saying.
Each Wednesday morning, check the chalkboard for any telepathic messages, then head over and download the latest episodes on your favorite streaming platforms, such as Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom.
And Pandora!
There you go.
Pandora.
I'm going to tell you Pandora. What's new with us with my mind.
Huh? What?
Can you hear it?
I have no idea what the heck you're talking about.
No? Oh, well. You can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to find out
funny.
More about us.
He tried to touch your mind.
Finally, take a deep breath of steam and head on over to our website to check out our entire list of episodes. Head to filmlosophers.com.
That's right. We got over 190 episodes now. We've hit that 190 mark, and so like I feel like we're just really moving along and, you know, doing some awesome stuff now.
190.
Right?
So close to 200.
Well, I mean, make it sound like it's so far away, but...
I just said it was so close. What does that even have to do with anything?
Because it felt like it sounded like it was further away than it would have.
What? How does saying so close make it sound far away?
Because we're weird like that.
Oh, gosh.
Before we get into the review, we do also want to make mention that we do have a really great announcement at the end of the show, so stick around to hear more about that. But, like I said, you are here to hear us talk about Dr. Sleep. That is right. We had an interesting opportunity to check out the film. Now, I know it's been a week since the last time you heard from us, but life happens. We've had some things come up, and unfortunately, we were unable to record last week, but we are back. We needed a break. Halloween was just too much for Spencer, and we had to give him some time. So... So with that said, we're going to be talking about the film that actually a lot of people have been expecting for a long while now. And to be honest, I'm kind of glad we actually got a chance to do it. So before we continue, Spence, give us that official synopsis goodness.
Still irrevocably scarred by the trauma he endured as a child at the Overlook, Dan Torrance. I keep wanting to say Danny every time.
You can call him Danny. His name's Danny.
All right. Danny Torrance has fought to find some semblance of peace, but that peace is shattered when he encounters Abra, a courageous teenager and not a Pokemon, with her own powerful extrasensory gift known as the Shine.
The Shine.
Instinctively recognizing that Dan shares her power, Abra has sought him out, desperate for his help against the merciless Rose the Hat and her followers, the True Knot, who feed off the shine of innocence in their quest for immortality. Forming an unlikely alliance, Dan and Abra engage in a brutal life-or-death battle with Rose, facing his fears and reawakening the ghosts of the past.
See, that went really well with the music until that tail end when you were having trouble with reawakening.
It's a hard word.
It is a difficult word. written, directed, and edited by Mac Flanagan.
See, words are hard. You know what happened.
You hear me. You hear my voice. I'm sick, okay? Let's try this one more time. Written, directed, and edited by Mike Flanagan. The film stars Ewan McGregor as Dan Torrance, Rebecca Ferguson, and Kylie Curran in her major feature film debut as Abra. The main ensemble cast also includes Carl Lumbly, Zan McLaren, Emily Aylin-Lind, Bruce Greenwood, Jocelyn Donahue, Alex Esso, and Cliff Curtis. Cliff Curtis, the man. He's the guy from most recently Fantastic. No, not Fantastic. What was that? Hobbs and Shaw movie.
Oh,
he played cool. The brother. So, a couple of quick notes. Stephen King first got the idea for Dr. Sleep in 1998 at a book signing when somebody asked him what happened to Danny. This was a question King had often asked himself, as well as what would have happened to Jack Torrance had he found AA. King started thinking about how old Danny was and where Wendy was now and decided to find the answers with a sequel, but it was a tall order, and no doubt it was. Oddly enough, I read the book and I listened to the Audible book, and in the audio book, Stephen King actually voices his little epilogue, I guess. Not really an epilogue, but it's just like a message to the readers. Oh, nice. And he talks about that, how he had spent many times like in the shower kind of piecing together and creating this would-be life for Dan Torrance and how it would have came about. And he said he, in his mind, he had like charted it all out, and he finally came to grips that he was in like 2009, I believe it was, when he had a conversation with somebody who actually was a recovering alcoholic. And he said the guy had told him a line that stuck with him. And he said the man told him that when an alcoholic is at his deathbed or comes face to face with death, it's not his face he sees that flashes before his eyes. And which he said, Stephen King said, it kind of spooked him and kind of had him come to grips in the book writing, and made him ultimately create what is now known as Dan Torrance in Dr. Sleep. Hmm. So that's actually really cool. Mike Flanagan actually had to convince Stephen King that despite his own distaste for the 1980 Stanley Kubrick adaptation of the film The Shining, audiences were more familiar with that version and largely preferred it to King's own The Shining that was done in 1997. As such, this film had to be a sequel for Kubrick's film and include some direct references to it.
Yeah, that must have been painful for Stephen King.
Oh, it was. It probably had to be like just downright gut-wrenching, because everybody knows, like, it's literally all over the place. There's nowhere you can go that people don't know. The original The Shining back in 1980 was probably Stephen King's most hated adaptation of his books. Oddly enough, I believe it was like his second adaptation too, the first being Carrie back in 1976. But this film carries a lot of animosity for Stephen King, and yet the book has a lot more tied into the original novel because it's based as a direct sequel to the book. Seeing as there was a lot of changes that had to happen in the movie to equate to the equivalent of being the sequel to the movie 1980s The Shining rather than the book, I was wondering how that worked out for Stephen King. Like, I know there had been some like special things that we had seen, like special sneak peeks or whatever on TV or on YouTube, how like Stephen King went to go visit the set and Mike Flanagan was like, this is a dream come true and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, how much was like Stephen King like gritting his teeth, like trying to be like, I don't want to be here. Like,
you know, to be perfectly honest, I thought they were just going to like, you know, early on be like, this is like a direct sequel of the 97 movie versus the 80s one, because I just thought he was that mad about it that he would not even like let that happen. Yeah. So like when you get the first hints that it's like, oh no, we're from the 80s one, I was like, oh, I was not expecting this. And it was actually rather nice.
Oddly enough, because I mean, here's the thing. we talked about this in the last episode, lesson 191. Sure. I believe it was lesson 191 or 192. One of those. 192. In lesson 192, we did talk about the film adaptation of this book, The Shining. Go ahead and check that out when you get a chance. But we did talk about it and how, as unique as it was and how much it strayed away from the book, it still has its unique charm and kind of weird cult following for that film. There are like certain things that didn't really like translate well across time, you know, like that didn't age well, such as who smokes a cigarette at breakfast with cereal kind of thing. Or like there's just a lot, like being okay with your husband like yanking your child's arm out of socket or whatever, like being so passe about that. But needless to say, it's one of those movies that, yes, there's a certain type of allure with it, probably more based in the cult classic following that it has, more so than its ability to create like fear and dread. But seeing as Mike Flanagan went the route of like creating a sequel to that, in all honesty, was a pretty gutsy move.
Yeah.
Like pretty ballsy, if you ask me, plain and simple, to be able to say, you know what, Stephen, talking to Stephen King, you know what, Stephen, I know you didn't like it, but guess what? More people saw that movie than the 1997 direct-to-TV, you know, version you did, which I'm pretty sure was great, but with its 2 million viewers of it, with the hundreds of millions of viewers that have seen The Shining, I think I'm going to reference that one. And that had to have been like a really hard conversation for Stephen King to kind of acknowledge. The idea of this film or this book, just going back to the book, the idea of it is pretty interesting because of the fact that this was like actually Stephen King's first sequel, like direct sequel to any of his books. He's never created a sequel before.
Huh.
And so this one kind of is that interesting, odd one out, if you want to call it that, in terms of its ability to create a continuation of a story that Stephen King had immense success with it the first time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So taking all that into consideration and seeing as this film was finally released last Friday. Now we, oddly enough, like I said, we had a chance to see it a couple weeks ago at an early access screening. However, like I said, life happens and we had to take a week off just for the sake of, you know, getting some things situated and getting us back onto the groove. But when we saw it, it was before it had made, obviously, its wide theater debut. But it did debut this past weekend. And we do have some of the numbers where the film had a budget of $45 million. And it's in its opening worldwide weekend, the film did do $34
million. That's not bad.
That's not bad at all, especially with films like, you know, what was that? I just mentioned it. Hobbs and Shaw. That one debuted with like a $19 million weekend and was one of the number one films of the weekend. So I don't know so much as like how close this was to being like the number one film for the weekend, but I'm pretty sure it had to have been up there. There's really literally nothing else that came out this past weekend. It does look like it was number two. It was beat by Midway.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But it beat out Playing with Fire. Thank God.
That's not surprising. So I don't know why you're even relieved.
Those types of movies don't need to happen. Plain and simple. We don't need any more Disney Channel type movies. We already had The Pacifier.
Is that even by Disney?
I don't know.
I don't think it is.
It feels like it.
It's not going to be on Disney Plus.
It's distributed by Paramount. Who owns Paramount?
I would assume Disney, since they own like 60%.
They pretty much own everybody. Yeah. So. I don't know. It's like, and speaking of Disney, quick side note, I have lost sleep over Disney Plus. So I'm still gathering.
Did we both do the same thing where we were up at midnight watching Disney Plus?
No, it dropped at 11 o'clock.
See, when I tried to get it like at 11:30, it wouldn't let me.
I got it at 11 o'clock. I began perusing from 11 till 1. I hadn't even watched anything. I was just going through all the categories from 11 o'clock until 1 in the morning. And then I'm like, all right, I need to start seeing some stuff. And I started watching some of the shorts. And then I realized it was getting later. And I'm like, all right, I need to see something like monumental so that way I can at least have something to show for it in the morning. And I ended up watching The Mandalorian.
Because that's the correct answer.
Of course. Is there anything else? I mean, unless you're going to boost it up onto the TV.
No, if you're talking about something new, it's The Mandalorian.
No, I know. But all the movies that are on there are in Ultra HD.
Yes.
I could watch Return of the Jedi on Ultra HD. Okay. How can you go wrong with that? I could go and watch Rogue One.
Rogue One was great.
It was incredible. And I would be willing to see that end fight scene with Darth Vader in Ultra HD any day of the week.
They should just pop that out and make it its own short. Because,
oh my gosh. And mind you, I was torn. I do have to admit, I was a little torn. It was either watch The Mandalorian or watch Lady and the Tramp. Just because showing some support to our fellow Latino actors out there and Latina actresses with, you know, you got Adrian Martinez over there playing the dog catcher. Got to give a little shout out to homeboy. Whoop, whoop. but, of course, I went to the other Latino actor, and that was Pedro Pascal as the Mandalorian.
There you go.
Which, mind you, if anybody was going to play the Mandalorian, the closest thing we had to like what Boba Fett was like or anything, I think Pedro Pascal is a perfect like choice. Mm-hmm. Like the way his voice sounds and just his mannerisms, I was like, this is all right. I want it all.
Yeah, no, like just from that first episode, I'm pretty into this show.
And
I am not a fan of waiting each week for an episode.
And that's what I was going to say. This is like, that's their like biggest dirty trick of all.
Yeah, it's stupid.
Yeah, they're doing, so I ended up buying just a whole year's worth. I ended up doing the whole year package. Mm. But they're doing like a week trial right now. So if you sign up for it, you can get a week trial for, you know, 7 days, obviously, and then they'll charge you the regular price. Well, sometimes some people's weeks are like 5 days or 5 business days, like business
week. That's not a standard week.
You tell businesses out there, okay?
Okay.
But with that, like, you get to see, like, the one episode of a lot of their original stuff. They have something with Jeff Goldblum, like a regular series.
Yeah,
how are you going to say no to that? What is that? The Wonderful World, according to Jeff Goldblum or something? I don't know. Yeah. Something.
The first episode is about him checking out sneakers.
Does it matter if it's Jeff? I watch those darn apartment commercials just because he's in it, and I have no idea what he's trying to sell. I just know it has to do with apartments.
Okay.
But I watch it. It's Jeff Goldblum. I'd be mad to not watch it.
Would you? It is an advertisement.
Yeah. Spencer, I'm the type of person that'll sit in front of the TV and watch those Time Life infomercials if it's on somebody interesting. I went to Red Robin the other day, and I was sitting at a booth, and across from me at the other side of the room through the glass by the bar, which is on the other side of the restaurant, they had a Time Life infomercial on Robin Williams. I have no idea what was talked about at the table because I was laughing to myself at all the Robin Williams jokes that were on that Time Life. All I know is I got to go to www.timelife.com/Robin because I need to buy whatever it is they're selling.
This is just so ridiculous that you're putting out like ads for things. They're not giving us any of those kickbacks.
Well, you know what? They've never done it before. I don't know. I'll let them know. Like, hey, by the way, I just dropped the link for your Robin Williams album. So, like, for real, we should get some money on that. Like, come on. But
it's like a reverse business partnership. It's like
whatever.
The exact opposite.
Like, don't even pay us. Just send me a copy of what you got. I'll be fine.
Show me what you got.
Exactly. Show me what you got. But I digress. Yes, Disney Plus had me awake last night, so I am fully coherent but a little drowsy. So we're going to make this work. So going in, obviously, Spence and I had to get a chance to go see The Shining, the original one, and we talked about it last week. Make sure you check that out, Lesson 192, The Shining. But with that, the good thing about that is it did actually prepare us well enough for this particular film. because this one is, like we said, by default, a direct sequel to that film. Mm-hmm. The great thing, though, is it doesn't take away from a lot of the original great things, the original unique things from the book, but it does divert quite a bit from the original property, the original story element, the original resource.
Well, isn't this mostly because of the movie changes, right?
Yeah. So a couple. So we're not going to talk about spoilers, I don't think. No, we're not going to talk about spoilers. The film just came out. We're not going to tell you the end. But we are going to be talking about some of the more pertinent things about the book and the differences between the book and the movie, which we're not, like I said, we're not going to talk about the ending, but there are elements of the story that really do differ. So there are a lot of different elements from the first, from the book to the movie. One of them, one of the biggest ones being in the, and you see it in the trailers, you see it in the advertisements for the actual film. You see them going back to the Overlook. Mm-hmm. Whereas anybody who has read the books or has seen the 1997 adaptation of The Shining, you know that Jack Torrance actually blows up the Overlook, burns it down by overheating the boiler. So he ends up killing everything and killing himself, blah, blah, blah. Leaving Wendy and Danny, and according to the book, Mike Halloran, who survives as well.
Yeah.
So I say all that to say, that's one of the biggest ones, but we'll get into the rest of them as we dive in. But first I want to go ahead and ask you, Spence, like, knowing you had seen The Shining and knowing what you were going to be getting into with this film, what was your biggest expectation coming in, including, in fact, including all the like advertisements and the trailers and whatnot?
My biggest hope for this movie was that it didn't suck, really, to be perfectly honest.
I'd say it's a pretty good expectation.
I feel like
that should be like every time we come to this, like, I really hope this film wouldn't suck.
Well, like, you know, there's some movies with trailers where you're like, I know I'm not going to like it. For instance, Playing with Fire.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, you know you don't want to really see that movie because it's not up your alley.
No.
This movie portrayed itself in a way that seemed like, you know, it was going to be pretty good. So, like, just from really the trailers is the only thing I was exposed to. I didn't read the book like you did. But, like, you know, I like Ewan McGregor. He's always great in the things I've seen him in. So
you've just seen him in Star Wars.
You don't know.
I know. What else have you seen him in? Go ahead.
We're not putting him on trial right now.
Yeah, that's what I thought. No, he's been in a lot of other things, but So your biggest thing was just that it wasn't
Christopher Robin, which we saw. There we go.
Oh, were you actually looking up like other things that he's been in so that you don't have to feel bad?
Yeah.
Okay, just checking. So aside from that, any other expectations or any other thoughts in terms of coming into it? Because I mean, let's be pretty plain and honest. You are not, well, take a step back.
Wait, no, I am not what?
No, this wasn't going to be derogatory. Take it easy there, Chief.
Okay, like, remember who you are, though. That's kind of your brand.
What are you, Mufasa? Remember who you are.
This is exactly why.
No, what I was going to say is, remembering that you are not a huge horror movie fan. However, with our journey this past October, which has been really fun, you've actually kind of transformed into a smart horror movie fan, if you will, an intelligent horror movie.
Yeah.
So knowing that you're making that transition, did that journey at all make any impact on your thinking for this particular film?
Yes, it just left me more open to the idea of seeing it. And then not like just being like, hey, this movie's gonna suck before you even see it because it's a horror movie. So now I was more like, man, I hope this is smart, not stupid, because I'm not gonna like it.
Well, I would say that's actually a very valid point. I think for me, like, the biggest thing for me was knowing that it was gonna be referencing The Shining, like. So follow my train of thought here.
Okay.
Knowing it was going to be based off of, it was going to be a sequel to the 1980s, The Shining, I was hoping this wasn't going to be another one of those like derivative versions of the book, like, well, it's going to be like the story, but it's going to be more like Dan's actually struggling with his, like, with his battle against, you know, veganism. And he's going to be like, I didn't want it to be some type of weird interpretation of the book. I mm-hmm. wanted, because I had read the book a while back when it first debuted, like back in like 2014 or 2000 something. I don't know when it first debuted. However, I hadn't heard from it or whatnot until I hadn't reread it or revisited that until the movie debuted. And I was like, man, I don't really remember the book all that much. So I re-delved into like the book through audio and listened to it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember all this. I do. And getting a chance to revisit all that really reminded me like why I was so open to wanting to see this, because the book has so much more depth and unique energy to it that it makes it feel like, okay, you're like seriously gonna see some weird stuff, and it dives more into the mindset of like who the True Knots are, how connected are they, like where about their whole their whole, not their origins, but like where their essences truly come from, like why they do the things they do and why they're like vampires essentially. And after reading the book, and because I just finished the audiobook the other day, and actually today, and seeing the movie, I'm like, you know, he wasn't too far off, thankfully. And that's a good thing, because that was one of my biggest worries, was if the book was going to be if the movie was going to be like a complete, you know, side story-esque version of the actual book. So that was one of them. The second thing that I was kind of worried about was, you're going to create a grown-up version of that little kid from The Shining. That little kid was creepy. So my concern was,
okay, he saw dead people. I feel like there's a legitimate
reason.
Yeah,
but so did John Constantine with Keanu Reeves, and he was cool.
but you didn't see him as a kid, though.
Well, I mean, Keanu Reeves looks like he's been alive forever.
Yes, he
like
does.
He's immortal.
Yeah.
That man does not age. In fact, I think he's more active now than he was when he first did like the Matrix movies. Cause like this guy's doing craziness.
Yeah, he's in video games now.
He is in video games, and showing up at E3. Who is this guy? Okay, boomer. No, no. But like, I was really hoping that they weren't going to, since it was going to be a direct sequel to that, they were going to keep with the spirit of that film, and kind of keep that like creepiness element of it, cause that's the one obvious thing of the first film. Jack Torrance, played by Jack Nicholson, looked psychotic from the get-go. Like, he looked nuts. And I think making sure that there was an element of this film where that creepiness was just like this underlying feeling of this film, like there was something really, not slimy, but really just kind of dirtbaggy or like really creepy or really like maniacal underneath the whole subtext of the film.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was hoping that was always going to be. And yeah. So I think those were like the biggest concerns I had, because in all honesty, like I said, I had read the book way back when, but I didn't remember like any of it when the film actually debuted and when we went to go see it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't remember any of this. Have I, like, is this movie so far off that I'm just like, oh, and then I read the book, I'm like, oh, okay, it wasn't too far. Okay, cool. So, diving into the movie, obviously, first impressions after we got out of the film, Spencer, I'm going to go first. First impressions after the film. I have to admit, I was completely justified in my, not justified, but I was actually completely relieved of my fears.
Okay, I was about to say, that sentence was like, makes it sound like you hated this movie.
No. I actually really enjoyed it. The fact that this film feels like a sequel at heart to the original movie, it feels still like it honors the book. in a lot of senses. There's a lot of the parts of the film that continue to that carry on the heart of the book and really keep that moving forward, and still allows you to see like where it draws from the movie. And that's a really big mountain to climb, because of how far off Stanley Kubrick's The Shining deviated from the book. Like, it's like saying, it's essentially the contradiction of the old saying of you can't have your cake and eat it too. Like, it's literally, I had my cake and I'm eating it too, like with this book or with this movie, because the book, it's obviously more in depth. It has more elements of it that you can't really just flush out. The best way to put it, and I was talking about it with somebody today, the best way I'd put it is that this does long book adaptation better than Ready Player One did. And that's a big statement I'm saying, but I think it's true. I think this movie did it much better than what Ready Player One came up with. So, and if you have any complaints about that, I'll give you Spence's address at the end of this show. So
it's not going to help you.
But I really did enjoy it. I really had a good time with it. I think one of the great things about this film is that it did have a lot of the elements of dread and fear that Jack Nicholson had brought to the first film. But without having to have Jack Nicholson in this film, like Rose the Hat and the True Knots, like, were creepy as all get out. Yeah. I was.
Okay, but like,
it brings a whole new meaning to like, don't get into vans with strangers.
Okay, but didn't you feel kind of like Rose the Hat had like a similar creepiness level, like even at the beginning?
Oh,
of the
completely.
Movie?
No,
because the second she opened her mouth, I was like, child, you better run.
Oh, completely. No, and that was one of the issues. That was one of the things I was worried about. Like, if she was just going to become this like creepy person at the end, like this frustrated, mm-hmm. like, you know how most villains, they're like this all put together person until like the last act of the film, and they're like so distressed and disheveled, and they're like, oh, I'm gonna get you no matter what, blah blah, and looking like all crazy. Like, no, Rose, played by Rebecca Ferguson, is scary. Like, her ability to lure people into like this false sense of security and then have no issue telling them, yeah, you're gonna die now, like, we're gonna kill you, and do it in front of the camera, was pretty scary. And it created, like you were saying, that first scene, because the film opens on this campgrounds actually during the year of 1980. It doesn't say as to like when, like what time of the year, so you don't know if it's like before the events of like, well, I'm assuming it's all after the events of what happened at the Overlook Hotel. Mm-hmm. But you have like this whole sequence where this woman is singing a song by the lake, and this child just wanders over there. Like, which, by the way, parents back in 1980, you should.
What happened to Stranger Danger?
Yeah, like, where was that at? Because like, that's the Reagan era, and I know some of y'all know better. Yeah. Like, for real. That's not even, no.
Like, don't go too far. I'm like,
seriously? Don't go too far while I'm sitting down here, and you're gonna go to a lake where you could fall in. Like, yeah, that's parenting at its finest.
Yeah.
I'm like, my parents wouldn't even let me out of. We wouldn't even be there. Okay, we wouldn't have the money for an RV. We would be camping in our backyard. And you know what they would warn us with? Don't go close to the dog. He'll bite. Like, that was it. That was all. The dog wasn't a pet. It was a family security system. We were not allowed to go near the dog, and that was that. So that was camping, my childhood.
Yeah, I just didn't go camping because I'm allergic to everything outside.
You are.
Yep.
And sometimes inside too. Yeah. So, but
plus, like, if I was out at a river or something, my mom would have strapped me into that like life vest so hard, like.
None true, very true.
It's like, just wander off by yourself.
Yeah, no, like,
little
my parents.
7 year old?
My parents would have pulled out the actual dog leash and held on to me, like, nope, where do you think you're going? Nope, but this child just wanders off and then gets lured into this false sense of security. And then they end up, like, I guess nobody cares about children screaming or something. because they instantly eat that child right there and then.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. Like, there's got to be people around here that are tripping out and hearing these things. I don't know, though. Like, but she creates a lot of the creepiness for me in this film. And I think it's a great job. Rebecca Ferguson, who was known for her roles in the Mission Impossible films, latter in the franchise. This is a great opportunity for her to really stretch her acting skills. And I think she really nails it as a telepathic foe to an extremely like gifted young girl. And that goes us to the other side of that spectrum with Kylie Curran. Mm-hmm. That child, for this being, I didn't know it until today when I was doing the notes. I didn't know it was their feature film debut. Like, I thought that child had been like in several things.
Yeah, she comes across as she's been in something before this.
She comes across as she's been in a lot of things before. Like, yeah. I felt like she actually like had been in several other movies, because her ability to portray everything from like childlike wonder and whatnot to grown up demeanors. Like, there's a scene in here where she has to act like a grown person because somebody is inhabiting her. And that scene is so great that it's like, dude, like, I would have believed she was possessed by a grown man, because that does not seem like the child I had just been seeing on the movie screen.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos to this actress, because like her playing somebody
fantastic.
Like, yeah, someone playing Abra Stone, that's the child's name, the name that Spencer forgot, playing Abra Stone. And she does a lot of the subtle nuances really well from the perspective of somebody who's understanding, like who's becoming aware of her ability, to utilizing her ability, to executing her ability, and being able to just grow, like see her actually grow with this. I think it's great. I think she's going to go really far in this franchise, in this industry, because of the fact that if people are looking at this film as part of her reel of like, all right, let's see what good she is, like how good she is. By far, this is going to be a career defining role for her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I give it another 2 years before they announce that she's going to be headlining some really incredible movie. And then, of course, you have people obviously like Ewan McGregor. Ewan McGregor is always great.
Yeah.
Like, I've never come across a movie with Ewan McGregor or TV show, because there are times where, so I've mentioned it on the show before, I used to be a big fan of Tales from the Crypt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't watch it as much anymore because it's not really on any streaming services.
Okay, I was about to say, it's on now?
No, it was. Okay. I've always watched it on streaming services, whether if it was like Shudder or something else. But because Ewan McGregor played a vampire. I played a zombie in one of the Tales from the Crypt episodes. Really great. But nevertheless, from Trainspotting to Obi-Wan Kenobi to, you know, even Trainspotting 2 to everything else that he's done, even we were just talking about a Christopher Robin to Big Fish, Ewan McGregor has always, always, always done something outstanding and stellar. And for him to play Danny Torrance was a tall order, because of the fact that Danny Torrance is a very unique person. Not to mention, in the book, much like the film, Danny Torrance is extremely flawed. Like, he's got some demons. Like, obviously, he's the son of Jack Torrance, so there's got to be something to follow up with the whole debacle that happened at the Overlook.
Right.
And the one thing that I think Stephen King nails on the head with this film is the awareness of, like, the hereditary nature of alcoholism, which happens in certain instances. However, in this particular film, thankfully, it doesn't go to the depths of how bad he was in terms of like how the book portrayed him. But in the book, like he is plagued all the time by his past sins from when he was an alcoholic. He does in the story and in the movie, he does end up in some small town and goes to an AA meeting and starts getting sober. But like his whole, the whole fight for him to finally get to the place to where he decides to get sober is like brutal in the book. And I like the way they portray it. In this one, they kind of streamline a few things. They make you somewhat aware, but not fully aware of like a lot of the ramifications of his decisions. But thankfully, the book, the movie does a really great job of showcasing what Danny has become as an adult and what his battles are and how they actually are similar in certain forms as were the ones to Jack Torrance. And that's a really hard choice to go with because of the fact that you're doing something that isn't so much focused on in the Shining movie, the 1980 movie, because you know he hasn't had a drink in so long. It's not very obvious, but you know that he, it's mentioned by Wendy that, oh, my husband stopped drinking. He hasn't had a drink in like 3 months. And then nobody talks about it again in the film. And then you find out later on towards the tail end or towards the middle part where Jack ends up finding a bar ran by ghosts. And he's like, it's been months since I've had one of these, Lloyd, and blah, blah, blah. And but it's not like, it's not a focal point.
Yeah.
And in this film, like, Danny's sobriety is a huge part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because knowing that how much that was an element of his dad that he does not want to tap into really kind of plays with a lot of real world issues in terms of people who struggle with that. And I think it's a great way to kind of add a little bit of moral lessons to the film while at the same time creating the great story that it is.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I kind of super, like, really appreciate it because, like, when it comes to children with psychic powers, very rarely do we see a movie where you see them as a kid and then we come back to them as an adult and see how they're faring with those same powers.
It's very true. Very true.
Because, like, we don't know what happened to Haley Joel Osment from The Sixth Sense or, you know.
Yeah, we do. We became best friends with Justin Long and his friend ends up getting turned into a walrus in Tusk. They start a podcast together. Okay, never mind. You haven't seen Tusk. It's okay. Continue.
All right, anyway. So, like, the movie had a great opportunity to see, like, you know, hey, what happens when these horrible demon creatures are chasing a child, and how does a child deal with that?
It's true.
Which is kind of an insane prospect, but, like, it's kind of very interesting because, like, you know, it came across that, like, a lot of some of the reasons that he, like, went to alcohol is just, like, he's being constantly attacked by all this crap all the time.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to wear on you.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
And I definitely agree on that because of the fact that Danny, you find, has been self-medicating, so to speak, and blackout drinking to minimize the amount of voices that he hears in his head.
Yeah.
Which it's almost like you would have to then begin to wonder, like, okay, well, you wonder, did Jack ever kind of deal with this kind of stuff? And it asks a lot more questions, but mm-hmm. all in all, I think the idea of it creating this sense of deeper, like, depth to not only Danny, but also Jack Torrance, I think really kind of helps paint a different picture for what Stanley Kubrick had originally done, which I think is a good way to really point back to Stephen King's original novel, which there was a focus of, like, alcoholism in the book, in the Shining book. Sorry. But it's really great, and I love how they continue this film in creating that sense of connectivity while still, you know, holding true to everything that Stephen King had done. Other great highlights of the film, I really enjoy the fact of, like, how this film really helps create that Stephen King sense of dread, because Stephen King is not the type to create, like, these jump scare-ish type of horror elements. And if you look at everything that's been prior to, like, you look at It or anything from Stephen King that most people know as horror films, like It or Christine or even Carrie, a lot of them have been like these almost like peak moments of fear. Like, not jump scare-ish, but they're like, all of a sudden this whole scene is about horror and fear and scariness and you're whatever. Whereas with this particular book and this particular instance, it creates this, if you want to call this, uphill roller coaster like incline of fear and dread with the characters that you're facing, like with the True Knots. The whole scene where they find that little boy, that kid with the baseball kid, and they go from like, and it's almost like an insider view of like what kidnappings look like. Like, I don't want to see this. I felt bad watching it, to be honest. But like,
yeah,
that whole scene, you know what they need and what they're doing, and you just don't know how it's portrayed, so to speak, in the sense of like them feeding off of these people. But then when you see the little boy, which the little boy, oddly enough, is played by Jacob Tremblay, great actor. We've seen him in a lot of other films prior to this. He was in that movie, The Good Boys, just recently released this year. I think it was this year.
Yeah.
That whole scene where he is completely freaking out and scared and like trying to, that actually, thankfully, is almost word for word how it's done in the book. And to see it being like portrayed in the actual film, it's a scary scene.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that sticks with you and you're kind of like, I don't need to see this.
True, because it's really rough to watch, and you're really seeing like if Jacob Tremblay was like really scared, that's what it would look like.
Yeah, because you know, like, it's not going to end well for this kid where this road's going. So I was kind of like, okay, I'm ready to go on to the next scene with like Abra or someone.
Yeah, like, but, and that's another element, like finding a hero in a child in this particular film. Yes, this is not a children's film, but there's definitely a child hero in this little girl, in the way she handles like a lot of the adversaries in this movie, like the way they handle a lot of the True Knots. There's one named Rose the Hat who is dead set on trying to get the they're trying to get the little girl Abra to find her so that they can feed off of her what's called her steam, which is essentially the essence of the shining that's in with everybody or within the people that have it. And she has so much of it that they're like, she's like this quote unquote whale where if they find her and they catch her, they'll be able to like feed for like ages or something. I don't know how it's like measured. Like, they never do talk about how it's measured.
Yeah, that was the only thing that also like got me about this, was that if Abra is supposed to be like, you know, stronger than like Danny ever was.
Yeah.
Like, how come she doesn't have the same problem that Danny had where things are just coming after her?
Because he awoke all the things that were at the hotel. That's why they know where he is. Which is why, like, there's a particular scene where Abra ends up getting one of the demons or one of the spirits that was at the Overlook in her own house.
So that only happened because she was there.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have bothered her otherwise.
Okay. Exactly. But it's just, I think one of the great things about this film is that it's so consistent and it's fluid. And I don't want to take too much time on this, but I think one of the unique things about Stephen King's works is that he's definitely one who likes to take time. This book was like over 500 pages. Doesn't seem like a lot, but that's 18 hours worth of reading, as I learned through Audible.
Okay.
It's about 18 hours worth of reading. So within all that time, Stephen King takes his time creating like a lot of these situations, because he not only portrays the situation from the viewpoint of like either Abra or Danny or even anybody else in the situation, or even Rose or Crow, But he portrays it. He gives a view of the situation from multiple angles, to give audiences like more of a widespread view of everything. And mind you, doing something like that, obviously it takes time because you're revisiting the same situation just from different viewpoints.
Right.
In the film, it does a really great job of concising all that down to singular scenes and still getting the meat of the scenes across. Mm-hmm. And it does a really great job of that.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I was kind of worried after I had heard about the film. I was wondering, like, because let's just be honest, book to film adaptations have not been on their A game as of late. I mean, let's just be frank.
Yeah.
I've not been a fan of a lot of the adaptations of books lately, mostly because a lot of them are like these young adult romance books, or like, I don't want to know about somebody who's dying and meets their love at the age of 12. Like, I don't
know. All the Nicholas Sparks books.
No. Hey, you take that back. You take that back. No. I'm a fan of Nicholas Sparks, by the way. no, like these The Fault in the Stars, or like this last one where this child was like practically a bubble girl and she goes out, breaks out of her house after being allergic to everything, or this other one, what is like The 6-inch Rule or something. Yeah. I don't know. And I, no offense to everybody else who likes that, I don't care. Like, that's not my cup of tea. If I'm gonna see a book to film adaptation, let's do it how it was done, like back in the 80s and 90s. Like, let's get a Stephen King novel put out there and it'd be like a 7-part series on ABC. Like, what were the times like that? That's what I'm hoping for. And mind you, The Hunger Games, it was okay. There were parts that were like, there was a lot of big parts that I was like, I was really missing out. The Harry Potter books were okay.
I'm still mad that they burned down Ron's house in the movie. That was so pointless.
That's like the most random thing. They burned down his house. Where are the Weasleys going to live now? And then you got things like, what was that? Like The Maze Runner. I just left my house, and my brother and his wife were there watching TV, and they were watching The Maze Runner. I'm like, are you watching The Maze Runner? He's like, no, I'm watching The Maze Runner 2. I'm like, still, why? Like,
it's almost worse.
It is. It escalates in how bad it gets, because the first one was probably the best one out of the three. Two was meh. Three was god awful. Like, I would really wish we hadn't have seen three, and we did. And I'm so glad that we recorded that in my garage, because it did not deserve an in studio review.
No, it really did.
Much like since talking about recording in the garage, just like Pacific Rim 2. but that, like, even what was that? Immortal Engines or Mortal Engines, whatever
Immortal
it's called.
Engines, yeah.
Whatever it's called, that was god awful. Like, I don't know why. It was a book.
I forgot.
Like, where are the good book adaptations? This was one of those ones that, and probably going back to the beginning in terms of like my earnest fear, like, and this is just an underlying like fear of everything for every movie that has a book to film adaptation. I'm worried they're going to get lost in like the Hollywoodization, if you will, mm-hmm. of the book to make it really fit like the Hollywood aesthetic. Like, oh, instead of this person having like this, like, take Ready Player One, for instance. In Ready Player One, the character who plays Artemis, the woman who actually is the, not the avatar, but the woman herself, mm-hmm. she's actually a little Rubenesque. The book says she's a little bit Rubenesque. She's got the scar on her face, blah, blah, blah. And in this one, she's like this punk rocker, super rebellion leading type girl who's like, you go get him, I'll take care of these people, dur, 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 dur. Like, whatever, like, kind of thing. And I'm like, that wasn't her, but Hollywood wanted otherwise. And it was kind of like a little disheartening. Like, I wanted to see Wade's journal, and instead of seeing Wade's journal, we got this massive library curated by, you know, a robot butler. You know, and I don't know. There was a lot of elements that I was like, I mean, it was okay. It was fun. There were parts of it that were fun. But in terms of its true heart of the adaptation, it's not just, it wasn't necessarily there. With this film, I believe they hit the mark well. This was a better adaptation of a book that I've seen in a long while than anything that's come across our eyes in movie theaters as of late. Yeah. Like, I was very, as weird as this sounds, I was super proud and glad for Mike Flanagan creating an actual strong enough film that really touches on both the level of book lovers and movie lovers. And I, you know, I have to appreciate that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the thing about this movie is that it's kind of in its own league when it comes to adaptations, because, like, it just knocks it out of the park so hard.
Yeah.
That everything just looks like garbage next to it. Because, like, what the best thing we've got, like, adaptation-wise recently is probably The Hunger Games. And I'm not as familiar as the book as you are. What would you think about those? Like, how well do those transfer over?
What's that?
The Hunger Games series.
It was okay. Same thing. It hit a Hollywood moment in there where there was, like, there were certain elements, like, like, there were elements of, like, the creatures that were in the forest and the way certain things transpired, and it's like, like, not everything translated as well as it should have that had a large impact in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Take, for instance, the first Hunger Games film. At the very, towards the very end of the film, you have these large creatures that are going after Katniss and Peeta. Now, you're looking at these creatures and you're like, these are just like big dogs or something. And in the movie, it doesn't make sense. They're just like hounds or whatever.
Yeah.
In the book, they're actually DNA-derived animal creatures that were created from the DNA of every fallen person in that Hunger Games.
Oh, that's much more horrifying.
That is, and the only reason why you find this out is one of them is trying to claw its way up to Katniss, and Katniss looks at the eyes, and she's reminded of the same eyes that the little girl had.
I'm not reading these books because that's already upsetting.
But she notices, like, the piercing blue eyes of one and the color of the eyes in the other, and she realizes, like, the fear that these are actually people, which is why she, you know, she really pushes PETA to not attack them, because they may actually be human, or there may be some element of humanity in them. And that's a really big revelation to come by in the Hunger Games movies, because, or even in the book, you're like, in the movies, you're like, oh, look at these dumb dogs. Oh, they're trying to whatever, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I remember the dogs.
Well, you remember them?
Yeah.
Well, and then in the book, you're reading it and you're like, oh my gosh, that's like disgustingly distorted or whatever. Like, you're creeped out.
Yeah, and I think that's what, like, shifting back to the movie we're actually supposed to be talking about, I think that's kind of what, like, this movie does well, because, like, from, like, just the description of what you were talking about, like, this movie has that kind of dread in it, like, all over the place.
Yeah.
With, like, the whole, like, True Knot gang trying to kill people.
Yeah. And mind you, I do appreciate how well this film adapts the book in certain stages. Like, the first two acts of the film, I feel like they rely heavily on the essence of the original film and the heart of the book. It's the third act that comes in that really leans heavily on, like, well, this is where the direct sequel part comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And it just touches on the essence, or essentially the essence of the book, which, mind you, I wasn't that big of a fan of the third act. Like, I liked how it mimicked a lot of the things from the actual 1980 Shining.
Mm-hmm.
However, I had already seen that, you know, like, I've already seen Jack kind of, you know, intimidate Wendy, and to see it kind of replayed with Rose and Danny to a certain extent. And then even then, like, they try to bring back a lookalike of Jack Nicholson to play like the Lloyd character who was the bartender in the first film. I don't know if that was a really smart decision. Like, you don't need to rely on the accolades or the original cast performance of the first film to create the creepiness of what this film is already doing, because you already have the creeper in this film. Mm-hmm. It's the woman in the hat.
Yeah.
And she's nuts. And you didn't need to add on top of that a level of like added creepiness with this Jack Nicholson lookalike, which he didn't look anything like Jack Nicholson. No, other than the hair, he didn't look like Jack Nicholson.
No.
He looked more like Andy Kaufman. Let's be honest. He did.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
But, you know, I think, in all honesty, I think if the film had gone in a different route for the last act, I think this film would have had a little bit more of a cohesive storyline.
So I kind of disagree with you.
Oh, okay. Only
kind of.
Okay.
Because, like, I like the idea of Danny having to deal with his, like, the literal ghost of his father. But I don't know. There's something about him just kind of being like a Lloyd replacement that kind of like felt like it kind of took away from it, even though like him being at the bar seems like the right place for him to be at. Like, I don't know. They could have done something where like, where, you know, Danny actually has, like, you know, more of a confidence. Like, because the last time he actually saw his father, he was coming after him with an axe. So, true. Like he could still be coming after him, like, trying to kill him, since that was kind of how he left him before he died.
It's true. I don't know. I liked elements of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I liked how the mind traps that were happening, like in the hedge maze with Rose, or even how like the idea of Danny using ghosts to help aid them in, like, it seemed very like very Ghostbuster-esque in their attempt to doing that. But I don't know, I felt like leaning back a bit from how much they relied on the first film for that part took away from any original opportunity for them to create their own dread and fear in those opportunities. Like, I know what the fear and dread looked like in The Shining. You know, Jack Torrance running around with an axe, trying to kill people. I don't know if that was necessary to have that revisited with this film when the fear and dread was real in somebody that wore a hat with a long knife. Like, I think that was scary enough. But mind you, I mean, people will have their own opinions about it and how much they, I mean, I'm pretty sure super fans of the original film are going to be like, oh, it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Oh my God. It was great. Did you say that they brought back Jack Nicholson? Oh my God. You know, that kind of thing. Like,
they should have just brought back Jack Nicholson.
They should have.
He would have done it right.
Do they not understand the de-aging technology that is available out there? Like, he could have easily, like, yeah, he's just creepy all the way.
That would have, he would look like a puppet. Like, so, that guy from Star Wars.
You don't knock Admiral Tarkin, okay?
Yeah, that's the guy.
But here, okay, so then here's the final question I kind of want to leave you with before we kind of wrap this whole thing up. So then, with that said, where do you think this film draws the line with what is considered fan service to what is considered creating originality and consistency? Because the film was consistent with the first two acts in terms of its uniqueness. It drew from the original film with the elements of like Danny and facing his alcoholism and things like that, and The Shining and bringing back around, you know, having people like Dick Halloran in the mix and all this kind of stuff. How do you think, where do you think that measures up in terms of like fan fiction and where that comes into play, like the original storyline?
Okay.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think they were doing pretty well on trying to like use the Overlook as their own thing right up to the point where, like, Rose the Hat enters the hotel and she sees that blood elevator.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I was like, oh, well, now you're just borrowing too much from the first one. Like, I don't know what it is about that moment, but that moment kind of just felt like the tipping point for me.
Yeah.
And, like, that was like, okay, we're using too many things from the old film to try to be, like, creepy. Because, like she knows it's not there, so it's not creeping her out. It's kind of like a museum of interesting old things for her. Because, like, that's not going to hurt her or scare her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, like, really no point to dwell on it type thing. Because you're just trying to do, like, a fan service of, like, hey, you remember this stupid blood elevator that's been in, like, The Shining and a whole bunch of other parodies of it? It's here still. Like, that's kind of what it felt like to me. And I guess when the movie is focusing too much on, like, things we can see from the old movie, that's probably where it stumbles a bit with the Overlook Hotel. Because I did like the idea of going back there, because they did do some, like, really cool things. Like, when you first see the Overlook, it's like a shot-for-shot remake of, like, the intro to The Shining, which I thought was a nice touch. But I think that also kind of alludes to that they're trying to copy a bit too much from the movie as well.
And mind you, it's not a... It wasn't a bad third act.
No,
that's not what I'm saying at all. However, what I am saying is there's a lot that this film could draw from or could even lean into in terms of creating that sense of originality and that sense of, you know, that sense of pulling from the original storyline of the book. Because the book doesn't spend a lot of time dealing on that last act of the film. It's not, like, glorified as well as this film does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that book actually rounds it out a little better. Yeah, I don't know. Like, for me personally, I think I could have done with less of the Overlook and The Shining. I could have done with a little bit more focus on, like, Dan's battle, not his father's battle. I know they're trying to make the parallel draw that Dan's battles were his father's battles, but no. In the book, Dan Torrance has his own struggle and his own battle, and he has to own up to his own issues and his own sins of being a drunkard and what it's caused prior to. The fact that this film pulls into, like, well, we're going to tie you to this because you and your dad are one and the same, I think that's kind of a little bit of a cop-out of a story and storytelling in terms of that. But, I mean, overall, the film is still good, you know.
Hmm.
So before we wrap up, Spence, is there anything else you want to add in terms of this movie?
No, I've covered most of the things that I was terrified by this movie.
It's good to know. Well, wrapping this whole thing up then, let's go ahead and go across the table. Spence, does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Definitely passes. I'm going to give it a 4 because I was really impressed with this movie overall. Because, like, it managed to be a really good sequel and adaptation of a book, which apparently is a tall order these days.
It is. Don't get it twisted, Spence. It is.
Yeah, no. So I was really impressed with it.
Same here. The film passes for me. It does a great job at creating a thorough sequel that carries the heart of the original film as well as its source material. However, it does get a little muddy in that third act. In terms of monocles, I am going to give it a... What did you give it?
4.
I'm going to give it a 3.8.
Ooh, 8.
Because of the fact that it's close to a 4, but it's not exactly a 4. Because I wanted this to be so unique that it was going to stand alone, but you need to understand a lot of the original film in order for you to actually get a lot of the pieces for this movie. Much like you have to read the original book to get a lot of the original book, but you wouldn't have read the sequel book unless you had read the original Shining book altogether.
Yes.
So yeah, but that about wraps up. So I'm gonna give it a 3.8 and yeah, everything I said. So that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us all out at our website at filmlosophers.com, where you can catch all of our episodes, over 190 episodes, and check us out there. We also have our website or our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers and our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101, as well as Instagram at filmlosophy101. We do have an Instagram page. I need to get on that, but you can start following us and I promise we'll put something up there. Before we go, we did want to mention a quick announcement. This weekend, if you are unaware, there is a thing that is going to be going down on Saturday called Extra Life. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Extra Life actually unites thousands of gamers around the world to play games for 24 hours straight in support of their local Children's Miracle Network Hospital. Actually, since its inception in 2008, Extra Life has raised over like $50 million for sick and injured kids. So gamers all around the world will be playing games nonstop, and we'll actually be a part of one. Myself and Spencer, we actually have a friend who will be hosting his 24-hour stream on Twitch. Mm-hmm. His name's Rob. I don't know what his username is.
That's Achilles2.
Achilles2. So we'll be with him, helping him out, joining his stream, and being a part of that and raising money for the local hospital that is here, local children's hospital. So we're definitely excited to be a part of that. If you want to know more, head over to our Facebook page and our Twitter page. We're going to drop the link to his Twitch channel as well. We'll probably be doing some live Facebook stuff as well as some Instagram stuff to send you the information on where you can watch us there. So be on the lookout. We're going to be doing some stuff. We're going to be doing some fun gaming, and we can't wait. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Bottom line, it going to be fun on the bun. So, but that about,
all right, Bender.
That about wraps up another awesome episode. And like we said, that film, mind you, check it out if you get a chance. It's in your local theaters. There's really not much else playing. Not until next week. Probably something else new is going to come about. But check out your local listings. Let us know what you think. Drop us a line on our Facebook and Instagram and Twitter page. And we'd love to hear you all about it. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.